It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
We're at a farm, and it's not just any farm. It's a farm that's located kind of almost in Cincinnati. It's on the edge of Cincinnati. It's a beautiful place, and some interesting things are happening at this farm. And I'm really fortunate today to have two people that are covering crops and livestock at the Turner Farms outside of Cincinnati, actually Indian Hills, Cincinnati. And I want to welcome Danny Luskamp and Abby Lundergan. And Danny and Abby, welcome to Farm to Table Talk. Abby, I want to start with you. This is not a typical farm.
I think that we are pretty unique in terms of our location and everything that we have going on at the farm. The farm is 200 acres, about 100 of it is woods, and we are growing certified organic vegetables on approximately 8 to 10 acres. We have a farm market on site here where we sell the vegetables, and then we also go to a couple of farmers markets in the area and have a CSA program that has about 60 people during the summer and about 20 during the winter. And that's just the vegetables.
Well, Danny, you're on the livestock and pasture side of it. Kind of explain that part of the farm.
We raise generally most of your common meats you'll find in America, save for goat. But our red meats, our lamb and beef are 100% grass-fed. We rotationally graze them through our pastures. We have hogs that we raise outdoors. We do not breed them, but we purchase them locally. We have a mobile laying hen chicken coop, and we have meat chickens that we move through the pasture to help fertilize whatever the red meat animals are eating.
Explain to me why Turner Farms exists.
In my own words, I would say that we've been entrusted with this land and this operation. Our founder, Bonnie Mitsui, her vision was to create a farm where people could come to this farm so close to downtown Cincinnati, feel like they were a few counties over, and preserve a way of life, but also to help teach people responsibility, both to what we put in our mouth as well as responsibility to the land and to the earth that we have stewardship over. So we exist to both educate and take care of what we've been given.
Abby, do you have anything to add to that explanation?
I think that's a good summation. Danny and I both joined Turner Farm as staff members after Bonnie Mitsui, the founder's, death. So in the time that we've been here, Turner Farm has been a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And like Danny said, dedicated to education and to preserving a certain kind of agriculture. And the biggest principle that's at play here, as Danny alluded to, is the idea of having a dedicated place for people to connect to their food and to connect to the land itself. And we exist so that that opportunity will always be here in perpetuity.
Many young people would love to be farmers. What was the journey that brought you two to Turner Farms?
I actually studied art history when I was in college and did a couple of internships, or I worked at a gallery for a little while, and just decided that that world was not really where I wanted to be in my career. I didn't want to spend the money on going back to graduate school for art history. And I kind of wanted to do something that had more of a tangible outcome every day. So before I was here, I worked on a goat dairy farm that was also a Montessori school in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and then moved back to Cincinnati and was an intern here at Turner Farm. And I just really have decided that I like being able to basically wear pajamas to work every day. I like being able to get dirty and not having to get, you know, dressed up and get ready to go to work. And I really like being outside and having a job that is physical every day. So I've just stuck with it because I can't imagine not doing it every day.
You know, you're describing, I think, a feeling, a motivation that fits for a lot of people that listen to Farm to Table Talk, the people that I've heard from. Danny, how about you? What was your journey to this spot?
I had a love of languages in high school, became a Marine Arabic linguist, and now I'm here.
Oh, well, now that's, there must be some filling in the gap. There's not a lot of opportunity for a linguist. Or...
I deployed to Iraq, to Anbar province, desert, bombarded by dust storm after dust storm. It was wildly apparent they really had a really hard time feeding themselves. There's very little topsoil, hardly any water to be found, except unless you're right on top of the Euphrates River, keeping in mind that this used to be the Fertile Crescent, and we're just walking around in dust everywhere. So I made a promise to myself and my wife to come back to the States and become, as Abby has been saying, as self-reliant as possible and grow as much of our own food as possible. I found I had a knack for growing vegetables and fruits in Georgia, Augusta, Georgia. We got chickens, which are also known as the gateway livestock, and the rest is a very big blur. We got meat rabbits, tilapia via a downspout rainwater aquaponics system, where we grew the food for the tilapia. It took forever. I don't recommend that. We had ducks, Muscovy ducks, and eventually I began to find my passion was actually in teaching people how to do what we were doing. We formed an organization, the Hobby Farmers of the CSRA. We started going around and advocating for people, going to zoning meetings, talking about why all chickens are not bad for, you know, bad for business in a city, helping people to have a little bit more beneficial outcomes and have a voice other than their own. We decided to return back to Cincinnati, and we ended up starting our own farm on my in-law's land while we were looking for our own place. I eventually, I guess, was heard of by Turner Farm, offered a job here, and so basically I am one of those people where I'm trying to fund the startup of our own farm. We did purchase land, old rundown soybean ground, in 2016. So I'm basically existing here to fund the initial build-out of our livestock and diversified fruit and nut farm.
Boy, I love hearing stories like this. And, you know, you remind me that I actually met somebody across the river here because we're just on the north side of Cincinnati. But I actually had a chance to meet Wendell Berry. He's got sheep running on the Kentucky River, similar to some of the approaches you've taken. And when he talks about the ideals that he thinks that people can get back into, it's a lot what you're talking about. You're both nodding as I'm saying that, so you apparently have read Wendell Berry. He's shy, though. I tried to get him on the podcast, and I haven't been able to get him talked into it. You know, when I look out the window, the barn that we're sitting in and talking right now, it's beautiful country. It's like many areas I've seen around the country, though, not many any prettier than this is. There's some woods, there's pastures, there's some flat crop land. So it would seem to me that things you do here would apply to many parts of the country, that there are areas like this that are near an urban area that may be, again, rolling land and some woods, and that they can have some livestock and crops. When you come to an operation like this that's dedicated to showing what people could do and for them to have a better understanding of what they produce, it strikes me that you're almost like an artist that's picking up your paint brushes and the canvas is blank. Abby, when you came and you looked at the land, what did you think of, I mean, in arriving at what crops and what you should be growing here that would be fulfilling your mission of demonstrating what could be done in areas like this?
That's a good question. I think that as you said, the landscape that we have here lends itself to the combination of rotational grazing that Danny's doing and growing vegetables on the flatter parts that we're able to do cultivated crops on. I think that in terms of the varieties or types of vegetables that we're growing or amounts, a lot of that is dictated by our CSA members and what we want to take to the farmers market, and what is kind of popular or sells well. Some of it is dependent on the weather. So, for example, things like brassicas, so like the broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower family, we have a little bit of trouble with those, whereas they might do better in like the northeast or northwest. So I think that we're in a pretty good place in terms of being able to grow a wide variety of crops. I want to say we have maybe 60 to 80 different crops that we grow every year.
Wow. And Danny, how about livestock? How do you walk into this place, and you look out the barn, you look at the pastures, how do you make the decisions on what livestock you're going to be growing?
So generally speaking, we try to approach things holistically. It's more ideal to have multiple species. So we want to have as much diversity both in livestock as well as the wildlife that's affected by the livestock. So ideally, we'll have animals that specialize in eating grass, aka cows, animals that specialize in eating legumes and broad leaves, aka sheep. We'll have animals that specialize in eating insects, aka chickens, animals that specialize in eating nuts, aka hogs. There's always going to be an animal to fill a certain niche in wildlife, and so we try to mimic that here on the farm as best as possible.
Explain the wildlife side to me.
So with rotational grazing, there's always going to be a tall patch of grass somewhere on this farm. I know a lot of people go out of their way to get rid of wildlife, to attack it, to remove it. But often the answer to one person's problem is another person's problem. Better worded, or for example, I have coyotes in the pasture. We do not go after them. We do not remove them. They get to feed on all the little rodents and the rabbits that inhabit our pastures and are thriving because of our rotational grazing, because there's always grass nearby. In so doing, Abby's problem of the deer, we hope in the future, in the coming years, as the coyotes become more prevalent, will start to diminish. It is a catch-22 because there's more food for the coyotes in the pasture. They're also better fed and don't have to chase the deer. Sorry, Abby.
So, Abby, he's apologizing for the way he treats the coyotes.
Yeah, I was going to add to that that even the fact of them eating the rodents, I think, is helpful to us because we do have a deer issue, but the mice and voles and rabbits that they're also eating is a benefit to us in the gardens.
Abby, how do you decide what you're going to plant?
We have a pretty good idea of what sells well consistently throughout the season. So I'll decide what we want to grow more of, what we want to grow less of, if there's anything new that we want to add or anything that we want to stop growing. And then I will kind of set our, what I call our major rotation. So of those variety of crops that we grow, we do popcorn, potatoes, and pumpkins are kind of the largest crops that we do, or they take up the most space of everything. So we have a kind of unique situation in that all of our vegetable fields are separated and compartmentalized all over the farm, and they're a variety of sizes. So we have ones that are as small as half an acre, and then we have some that are as large as 2 acres. So the first thing that I do is set the location of those crops that are going to take up 1 or more acres the following season. And then I just kind of fill in all of the smaller stuff around those.
Danny, I assume you're able to make good use of the livestock manure.
So we do an increasing amount of work with draft horses and in cleaning their bedding, cleaning their stalls, and their dry lot. We have to put that manure somewhere. We windrow it, compost it, and after it's been composted, what, Abby, 6 months to a year, it gets spread on the gardens, whatever the organic certification would be. Separately, not talking about the horses, but the chicken bedding that is in the brooder, we also compost that in windrows. The rest of the livestock, mainly the beef and the lamb, we will get a chance to graze cover crops in Abby's gardens every so often. And so that is a great way to get the nutrients onto the gardens when there are no crops harvested for a given amount of time, 90 or 120 days, in addition to those cover crops helping the soil in the gardens.
Danny, do you have the livestock slaughtered and processed into meat for sale?
Yeah, absolutely. We sell the meat in our farm market here. That's both retail cuts and wholesale. So half hog, whole hog, half beef, whole chickens, and the lamb.
So is it difficult to find a place to process meat?
Extremely difficult. That is one of our biggest bottlenecks for our region.
Now, I know some people, the way they deal with that is they actually sell the live animals.
Correct. So we will sell wholesale animals, a.k.a. By law, we receive the money for an animal, a half or a whole, and then we also provide transport to the butcher. For those who do not have, mostly it comes down to freezer space, enough freezer space to have a half or a whole hog or half of a beef, we will sell retail cuts in our store. That largely limits us to having a state-inspected or a USDA-inspected facility whose standards, especially in Ohio, are extremely stringent, and there are fewer and fewer abattoirs every single year.
What breeds of livestock are you producing?
So for the sheep, we have Katahdin hair sheep.
No wool. No wool sheep.
Correct. They do not have wool.
Right.
We have a separate breeding program for a breed of sheep called the Black Welsh Mountain Sheep.
I've seen them. They're really unusual looking. They got horns and they're black.
And they're naturally dyed black. That is their claim to fame. We are one of very, very few breeders. We're talking less than 20 in all the United States. We excitedly are trying to import new genetics to the U.S. More to come on that. The beef, we have Red Devon cattle. They were a triple-purpose breed in the 1600s, both dairy, beef, and oxen, or draft. They're extremely calm. Our bull, 2,000 pounds. He is a teddy bear that is incredibly strong. They're a low center of gravity breed. They're not very tall, and they flesh really well on grass. And for those of you who do not understand that terminology, they grow well on grass, and they finish or marble and put fat on grass. And by grass, I'm being lazy. It's grass and legumes and forbs, etc. For the chickens, we generally will go with a blend. Every year we change the breed so I know how old they are. Barred Rock, Black Australorp, Golden Comet, and those, that's our general rotation. We generally keep them for 3 years. Who have I left out? Hogs. The hogs, we use heritage breeds, but they are a cross, so large black, old spot, and a little bit of Chinese Mechan.
But those are pretty exotic breeds that you've got there.
Yes. So basically what we're looking for with heritage breeds, I guess you could say they're more closely aligned with the lard-type pigs, pigs that don't grow at the speed of light and grow really, really lean, pale-looking meat.
And then the fat's unusual too, isn't it? Is it
Yes.
high in omega-3s?
Yeah, so omega-3 is the ideal type of fat. And if animals are raised outdoors, usually that ratio should improve, but that also is dependent on everything else you're feeding it. Our pigs actually do graze on grass. Despite being monogastric, having a single stomach like people, these pigs do have an ability to digest grass much better than we could.
I've never heard of that.
Obviously, they can't digest grass as well as a ruminant, a.k.a. a sheep or a cow, but they will eat grass, they will eat clover, and the main thing that flavors the fat is in the last 2 weeks, whatever they're eating, be it corn, be it roots, insects, pumpkins, like we feed them and finish them here, crushed apple pumice, diversity in their diet means a healthier, more nutritional product for us.
Well, that's quite a story. Now, do you have acorns? Do you have oak trees with it?
We have a few oak trees in their paddocks that we rotate them through. I don't think we have enough, And everyone is familiar with oak trees and the Spanish hogs and the Iberica ham and the Spanish oaks. We have a couple hackberries in their pens, and they love nibbling on the little hackberries that fall in the fall.
Wow, that's incredible. You have heritage breeds of crops?
We do a combination of heirlooms and hybrid varieties for just about everything. Probably mostly the tomatoes, we do a good amount of heirlooms. Like, I think a lot of people are familiar with or request Cherokee Purple, like heirlooms that I really like. There's a couple of peppers. There's one called Jimmy Nardello that's like an Italian frying pepper that has really thin walls that is in Slow Foods Arc of Taste. So it looks kind of like a cayenne pepper, but it's actually sweet. And that's another heirloom that we grow.
You know, one thing that strikes me as you two are explaining it is that there is so much more variety available. I mean, there's some, you know, great food available in all sorts of stores, and you can go to supermarkets and buy products, but there aren't very many varieties. They're looking to have it be consistent and be able to ship it long distances and so forth. And one of the luxuries I think that you have, I say luxury, I shouldn't maybe put it that way as far as it being expensive necessarily, but you're able to pick somewhat rare breeds in Danny, in your case, or crops that are heirloom products and so forth. Do your customers understand how unique that is?
I think they do. And I think that is the number one reason for our high retention rate of customers. There's a lot of things that I didn't enjoy getting from the grocery store that I didn't enjoy the taste of before I worked here. Things like bell peppers, or even broccoli. I think just about everything is better. And I think there's a difference in taste that's definitely noticeable and really significant in just about everything that we grow between what we have here and what you would get at the grocery store.
Danny, how about with the breeds or the, I imagine even the eggs too, or the differences that people recognize?
Yeah, I think the biggest difference that people comment on is our pork. It is a night and day product compared to commercial factory-raised pork that's inside on concrete versus our heritage breeds that the meat is so dark people actually question if it's lamb. And I just have to explain to them that pork is not supposed to be the other white meat. People do really enjoy the fact they can come here and know that it's a handcrafted product, to use the term that Joel Salatin always likes to talk about. And they just trust, especially as Abby was saying, as they're coming back year after year and developing a relationship with us, they can ask us the questions that they could not ask someone that works at Kroger. We can answer these hard questions, these specific questions, and we can give them that relationship with their food.
You know, it's a really, really fascinating area, and I can see where consumers could start appreciating the fact that they can get unique vegetables and, you know, produce and the meats, and appreciate the fact that the flavor is different, the taste is different, they're coming from different varieties, different cultivars. But how about for farmers? How about for somebody that says, okay, well, I have some acreage. Maybe it's not large. Maybe they have a full-time job somewhere else, but they think they have available to them a small acreage. Maybe it's some woods and maybe some hills. Do you find that they are coming to you and looking at what you're doing, thinking that maybe they can copy what you're doing and grow some of those unusual black sheep or whatever, and take it and, you know, whether they're Pittsburgh, Columbus, or wherever else, be able to do some of the things you've done and apply it for them to get into that kind of farming system?
I mean, I think one of the things that we try and do, especially with my department, is we try and make things duplicable, replicable, and scalable, both down and up. And you can use these philosophies, these principles, anywhere in the country. For livestock, obviously, you're not going to use a breed that has no heat tolerance whatsoever in southern Texas or Florida. You're not going to put a breed who specializes in heat tolerance way up in Maine. However, I can say that some of these heritage breeds, when raised on a small scale, they do have production benefits. i.e. the Katahdin hair sheep we raise. They're what we call low-maintenance sheep. They flesh out really well on grass, but at the same time, from the farmer's mindset, if you get the right genetics, you're not spending 4 or 5 times a year trimming hooves and deworming and chemicals. So these heritage breeds do have a certain amount of production benefits that also coincide with commanding a higher return on your investment, so it is more profitable. And we really can't, to those small farmers out there who have the 10 acres or 5 acres or 1 acre of gardens, it's hard to compete with people on my side that have been doing Angus on 1,000 acres for 200 years. It's just not feasible.
Would it be feasible for them to do Devon in the case of the breed you talked about and develop some sort of a specialty market for them to with that breed?
Oh, absolutely. Obviously, you're getting into the scale, how much acreage they've got, whether they want to start their own breeding program. You know, usually the point of profitability is 5 cows minimum if you're going to get your own bull. There's a lot of logistical questions there, and one of the things Abby and I pride ourselves with is being open to the public, being that nonprofit educational farm. We have no problem answering a few of these questions that come in regularly, and Abby and I are trying to get to a point where we can hold some of these production side classes for people who are considering this line of work.
Abby, how about in your case, do you have people that come to you and looking at what you're doing and thinking that they have some space available and they either want to produce for their own themselves or maybe produce for farmers markets as well?
What comes to mind for me is that I think we do have a lot of home gardeners that are interested in our production methods, but even the people that come to us interested in our internship program are usually people that are interested in homesteading or producing just for their family in a lot of cases instead of producing on a really large, like 5-plus acre scale.
You use the term homesteading. What do you mean by that?
What we hear from people a lot is that they want to be more self-sufficient, that they want to be involved in producing their own food at home, primarily just for themselves or their family or their neighbors. And I think that, so I think of self-sufficiency when I think of homesteading, and then I also think of diversity. So they want to have a garden, they want to have chickens, they want to have, I don't know, maybe like a couple of livestock, like a goat or a cow or something. So I think when I talk to people about homesteading, it sounds to me like they're trying to be more self-reliant or provide more for themselves.
You know, Danny and Abby, I think that there's a lot of people that would be somewhat jealous of farming like you're farming because it's gotten to be that if you're going to be a full-time farmer, you have to have 1,000 acres or so. You have to spend $500,000 on equipment. You know, it's almost out of reach for a lot of people. And yet, what you're describing to me is something that is within reach to many people, to view this almost as a gig in a way. I mean, it's a part-time job, perhaps. Maybe it's supplementing something else, so they've got something that they're working on. They've got another job, perhaps, and they'd be able to add some livestock or add some crops, or if they're not trying to make income from it, that it's something that they're able to raise food for their own family and have the satisfaction of doing that as well. Is it fair for me to characterize it that way, that this is often supplemental income?
I would say definitely for those starting out, you know, if you're taking that leap going from homesteading to you need an income or you would like a supplemental income, this is that great next step. A lot of what we do with the small scale, you know, this nook and cranny farming, as some have said, a lot of it complements one another. So, i.e. with livestock, excuse me, we got generally, let's say, 1 cow per acre. A lot of people don't understand you can add a sheep per cow and you not lose any space. And then you can add chickens to that and not lose any space from that cow. So you can stack all these enterprises and make land work on a much more efficient scale because of that strength and diversity we were talking about earlier. So I would say for people looking for supplemental income, this is a great way to start. And getting to a point where you're starting to make a little bit of money will show these people how to make a lot of money if they want to make the plunge full on and turn this into their career.
Well, how about for the two of you? How did you find yourselves to be farmers? Abby, did you ever think that you were going to be working someplace like Turner Farms and being in charge of the crops? How did you get here?
Oh, that's a very long story. And I just want to add to Danny's answer to the previous question that or what you were saying about this being a feasible career for people. I think that that is one of the most significant challenges or issues with our food system currently is the fact that getting into agriculture and being able to make a viable living doing being just a farmer and not having off-farm income or not working at a nonprofit like Danny and I do is a huge issue. I think that young people are really, really hesitant, or if they're able to do it, are really, really challenged to successfully make a living farming on a small scale. And I do think that is something that should be a more viable career path for people. So that's one of the main things that I would like to see shift or change, about our food system is just getting more people into this career, and not necessarily just to feed themselves or their family, but to have, to be able to have, you know, a medium-sized, farm that they're able to support themselves with. But to answer your question of how I got into this.
People that are listening to this would like to know more about what you're doing at Turner Farms, or have you give them some counsel or advice or suggestions because they want to take a similar journey. How do they reach you?
We have a website that is turnerfarm.org, and there's a lot of information about our vegetable CSA. There's a list of all of our staff on the website, so I don't know if there's contact info up there. There is for everyone on staff, but that's there as well. And then my email address is just abby@turnerfarm.org.
And Danny?
And email is also best for me. And it's the email is danny@turnerfarm.org.
What advice would you have for others if they're saying, I'd like to go these directions, I'd like to produce livestock, or I'd like to start growing more of our own food?
So I would say sit down with yourself, come up with the goals of what you want your life to look like. Figure out, once you have that ideal, what books, what authors, what farmers out there are as close to your ideal as possible, experience that ideal. Read the book. Go find someone doing that in your local area. If there is no one in your local area, go somewhere else. Find that. Experience it. See if you like it. And then put your own twist on it to make it fit what you're wanting. Not every single method that every person has is going to fit every other person. And I would also say, you need to experience it. Don't just read books, buy a farm, and then think it's going to work. Experience it first. It is extremely difficult, yet rewarding.
And Abby, any counsel you'd have for people listening?
I would say that the easiest thing is whatever form it takes for you, just put more time into the relationship you have with your food. So whether that's going to the farmer's market instead of the grocery store, volunteering on a farm, just trying to grow a vegetable that you really like in your own yard, visiting a farm, joining a CSA. I think that even just things like trying to cook more or being a little more adventurous with what you eat, anything that is an act of investing more of your time and more of your energy into your relationship with what you're eating, I think is a step in the right direction.
Well, I want to thank Abby Lundergan and Danny Luskamp for being here with me on Farm to Table Talk, and I'm so impressed with what you're doing at Turner Farm, and I hope some people get in touch with you being here.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you, Roger.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.